From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump and his allies are celebrating today after a 22-month investigation ended with the attorney general saying the president's campaign did not collude with Russians in the 2016 election. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders spoke with NBC News earlier.
This is something, frankly, that should never have happened. This is a two-year waste of taxpayer time and dollars. They spent over $25 million on this just to find out that there was nothing there.
Also today, Vice President Mike Pence called the Attorney General's summary of the investigation total vindication. And President Trump said today Special Counsel Robert Mueller acted honorably. Democrats, meanwhile, are not satisfied. They're demanding Mueller's full report be released to the public. We're joined now by NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
And tell us more about the reaction on Capitol Hill today from lawmakers to what people have been waiting for a long, long time.
Well, like they were earlier this weekend, all of the members of Congress are kind of scattered to their home districts. So their responses are kind of trickling in from wherever they are, and it's are a little bit based on what they may be hearing from their constituents back home. But by and large, they've been predictable. Republicans are saying that this is good news for the president, and they're ready to start kind of moving on. Though we should say a number of Republicans say they do still want to see as much of the report as possible. And Democrats are saying that things are not done, that this is just the first step in a longer process of investigating this president.
And today, Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, told reporters that he plans to further investigate how the Mueller investigation got started. Do you expect that to go anywhere?
Well, I mean, he is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and it is in his purview to start an investigation like that. So it is entirely possible that he could use all of the resources that come along with that powerful committee to begin looking into that information. In particular, one of the things that the president has focused on here is whether or not the Steele dossier, which is that outside collection of information, whether or not that was a part of it. We do know bits and pieces about how that information was compiled and who was involved, but it's possible that this might be something Republicans want to investigate as Democrats in the House continue their own investigation. So it's kind of a counterpoint to things that are going on the Hill.
At the same time, it may be hard for Republicans to make the case to go back and look into that when they are saying that Democrats need to move on and stop looking into what happened in the 2016 election. Kelsey, Democrats are objecting to the letter from Barr. Here's Senator Richard Blumenthal speaking on NPR's Morning Edition.
The American people deserve the Mueller report, not just the Barr report. In fact, this set of summary conclusions from Attorney General Barr is completely inadequate. And if I might say, it is very elegantly but brazenly devious in framing the message without providing the substance.
How likely are we to get the full Mueller report? Barr has promised to release as much of it as possible. Could lawmakers force Barr to give it over?
Well, they could go down the route of subpoenaing the entire report and asking Barr to appear himself or even Mueller to have him appear before Congress. Though I will say that I don't think any of that will happen until we see how much of the report Barr is willing and able to reveal through the process that they're going through right now, which is kind of vetting what is classified information, what includes sources and methods. So this will take a few more weeks before we kind of see exactly what the totality of the public version of the Mueller report will include.
Now, as people know, if they've been paying close attention in the last 24 hours, Mueller cleared the president's campaign of conspiring with Russians, but he didn't come down either way on whether the president obstructed justice. Barr has interpreted the report to say he has not obstructed justice. What questions will Congress be asking about that issue?
Well, Democrats say that that it's really an open question about obstruction of justice, and it is something that they definitely want to continue to investigate, because part of the reasoning that Barr cites in this in the letter is essentially that they can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the president intended or what his intentions were with the public statements that everybody saw throughout the entirety of this mm-hmm. process, is his comments on the former attorney general and other employees other appointees. Now, I think that Democrats want to know more about that. And we have to remember what House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler has said over and over and over, is that there is a difference between crimes and impeachable offenses, and that the one is not necessarily the other. So they are going to continue these investigations. We just don't know exactly what form that's going to take, though we expect Democrats will probably let us know a little bit more about that as this week unfolds.
Mm-hmm. And just briefly, what does all of this mean for the people who have pleaded guilty or been convicted in Mueller's investigation? Do you think it means anything about whether they'll get pardoned?
Well, it's really hard to know that. The president has been not very eager to talk about the concept of pardons. That will be entirely within the purview of the White House. And again, that's one of those things that we will watch unfold as those cases unfold.
That is NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell in Washington. Thank you.
Well, as we heard, the Mueller investigation has ended, but the questions go on, and so does the business of Washington, including tomorrow the Supreme Court hearing two cases on partisan gerrymandering that could change how congressional districts are drawn. Democrats in North Carolina are challenging election maps drawn by Republicans, and Republicans in Maryland are challenging maps drawn by Democrats. The Supreme Court has never struck down a partisan voter map, and plaintiffs in both cases are hoping that theirs will be the first. So let's get a preview with Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Robin.
Start in North Carolina. Democrats say the 2016 redistricting plan by Republicans unconstitutionally tried to dilute the voting power of Democrats in that state. Make their case.
Well, this map splits 10-3 for Republicans for North Carolina's congressional delegation. And at the time it was written, one of the drafters of the map said that they came up with a 10-3 split because he didn't think it was possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats. Mm. In other words, the people who drew this map acknowledge that they drew it for partisan political reasons to favor Republicans, and the question is whether that is constitutional or not.
Right, because as we're going to hear, it's in some cases legal, but is it constitutional is the question. Let's go to Maryland, where the case focuses on that state's 6th congressional district, and Republicans there saying that then-Governor Martin O'Malley, a Democrat, overseeing the redistricting process, tried to dilute the power of Republican voters to ensure a Democratic victory. So what's their proof?
I mean, this is basically the flip story from North Carolina, where you have the Democrats drawing a map that splits Maryland's congressional seats 7-1 favoring Democrats. They did that by taking a lot of people from the heavily Democratic areas near Washington, D.C., and putting them into Maryland's 6th district, turning it from red to blue. And so, again, the question is whether this is okay or not.
Yeah. Well, in many states, the party in power does get to redraw the boundaries of congressional districts. It is legal for them to consider politics when they do this. But we understand there's a limit to how partisan you can be. So with these two states in mind, what's currently allowed? And, you know, how might that be taken into consideration when they're ruling on constitutionality, not sort of state legality?
Right. Some states set their own rules for this. Florida, for example, has a limit on the amount of political partisan preference that can go into drawing maps. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court struck down a congressional map in Pennsylvania for the same reasons. The question, though, for the Supreme Court to decide is whether the United States Constitution allows this kind of partisan gerrymandering. And so the more particularly, the issues here are, okay, if you're a voter and you live in a district that's been packed with members of the opposite party, so your preference is never going to win, you don't have any chance, are you being punished for your political views in a way that would violate the First Amendment? And have the people who've drawn the map basically violated the spirit of the part of the Constitution that makes House elections frequent because they're supposed to be responsive to the American people? So those are the kind of underlying constitutional concerns here.
And some people are saying throw the whole damn thing out and make it a slate where you vote, you know, 1, 2, and 3. But we'll just take that up another time. This is happening, the court considering these cases, ahead of congressional elections next year. Could the court's rulings impact the 2020 races in both North Carolina and Maryland?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if the Supreme Court were to say that partisan gerrymandering is illegal in some way, were to set some boundaries, North Carolina and Maryland would have to redraw multiple districts to comply. The question is how likely that is given the current composition of the Supreme Court.
Now, I want to ask you about that because the last time around, the court passed up an opportunity to weigh in on gerrymandering. What's different this time? And what's your sense of how the court's new makeup will affect a ruling?
What's different this time is that Justice Anthony Kennedy has been replaced by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Kennedy kind of punted the last time around. He had, in an earlier case years ago, said, you know, maybe partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. Maybe courts could weigh in on that. But he never sealed the deal. Then he retired. Justice Kavanaugh is in his seat. And Kavanaugh has not expressed views on political partisan gerrymandering, but other aspects of his record involving voter ID and a case about racial gerrymandering that the court heard out of Virginia last week. Those cases and his stances suggest that he is not going to be eager to limit partisan gerrymandering. And that would mean that the Supreme Court could say to all federal courts in the country, you know what? This is a political problem. Courts have no role to play in limiting partisan gerrymandering.
Well, this all starts tomorrow. But for now, this all just remains very mysterious. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School, ahead of two gerrymandering cases that will go before the Supreme Court tomorrow.
With 2020 approaching, we're talking with the candidates who are jumping into the race. Bill Weld is the only Republican challenging President Trump next year. He's the former governor of Massachusetts, and he's announced an exploratory committee for a presidential run. Bill Weld joins us now from Concord, New Hampshire. Welcome.
Hey, Jeremy. Pleasure to be with you here in New Hampshire.
Well, and first of all, before we get into some of what you're running on here in your campaign that you've formed an exploratory committee for, obviously the news today is all about the Barr letter summarizing the Mueller report. What's your reaction to it?
My reaction is that that's one of a great number of questions that are going to be answered between now and the election in 2020. And the question that was answered is, did the man who was elected president conspire with a hostile foreign power to procure his own election? And the answer is no. So, phew, that's a big relief. And now on to the next.
And what about the issue of obstruction of justice? Do you still have questions there, or do you think that this is – it's over and done with?
Well, I think the question addressed by the Mueller report, I think that question was answered. The obstruction of justice question was answered by Bill Barr and Rod Rosenstein. That's not to say that there aren't other matters floating around involving the rule of law and such questions. But the Mueller report, that question is laid to rest.
Do you think that investigations should continue on Capitol Hill?
Well, sure. I mean, I believe, as does everybody else, that the entire report should be made public. The House of Representatives voted 420-0 to have the report made public. That's a pretty convincing demonstration of national will. So I think we all deserve to hear the full story, and that's what I expect will happen.
You served in the Justice Department. You also served as legal counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, looking into what constituted the grounds for impeachment during Watergate. Do you think Democrats should try to impeach President Trump?
Well, I don't know that now is the time for that, honestly. I think that there's some very troubling things that have happened involving Mr. Manafort and the president that bear looking into, but I think to go down the road of impeachment right now is probably not politically the thing to do. You know, it appears vanishingly unlikely you'd get 2/3 vote in the Senate to remove the president. So that being so, I think Speaker Pelosi is probably right that our national attention is probably better directed elsewhere right now.
Does this Barr letter mean anything for you? Does it make you more or less likely to run?
It doesn't really. As I say, it's one of 10,000 questions. I'm running because I don't think the job is being done in Washington right now. They're not serious about cutting spending or cutting the deficit. I don't think this president is an economic conservative at all. I don't agree with the drift of foreign policy, insulting our allies and cozying up to our enemies. I don't agree with the thrust of the president's policies, either domestically or internationally.
When you say he's not an economic conservative, what do you mean by that? Because the deficits have gone up under President Trump?
Well, sure. I mean, the budget he just filed raised the deficit by another $7.9 trillion. That takes us to $30 trillion in deficit. And, you know, when I was governor for two terms, I cut spending in real dollars year over year, and I was ranked the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States. And that was as a newly elected Republican in the very blue state of Massachusetts. And, you know, the president, most of his life has been a New York City Democrat, and they don't really care all that much in the Big Apple about balancing the budget. But governors, all governors have to have a balanced budget. And the truth is, we really should have a requirement federally to balance the budget as well.
What would you do to do that now, though? Would you cut spending or would you raise taxes?
No. You have to cut spending. I would cut spending and then cut taxes. But the spending comes first. You have to cut spending before you can cut taxes. And that's what I did. I cut spending year over year. And then I cut taxes 21 times and never raised them. And that is very good for employment and jobs because the business community gets the idea that it's a one-way ratchet. And all the tax cuts don't have to be huge, but as long as it's only going in one direction, and that's lower taxes, that gives business and employers confidence to build the extra plant, to hire more people, to buy more equipment. And that's, you know, that's the gist of our economy.
Where would you cut spending, though?
You know, I think you you can cut it across the board. What I did was to assume that every account starts at zero unless it can justify itself by the results last year. In Washington, they base the budget on inputs, i.e. last year's appropriation. What I did in Boston was to base it on outcomes. How successful was this program last year? That's called zero-based budgeting, and that's what you have to do to cut spending.
Do you think, though, that you would really have to go after entitlements to make a real dent in the debt?
Well, I think there's things that can be done. You know, I think in healthcare, we don't have a consensus in Congress. So, you know, I think the debate about Obamacare is not really being very productive. But I don't see why we don't let people purchase drugs across state lines or even from Canada and other countries. I think we should allow people to have health savings accounts so they can plan how much health care coverage they want for themselves instead of having some bureaucrat in Washington tell them exactly how much they have to have. I think people should be able to have, as they do, individual retirement accounts and make their own decisions about the level of protection, the level of risk that they're willing to shoulder. Too often, I think, too many decisions are made in Washington instead of leaving healthcare, for example, to doctors and patients. So, you know, I'm a smaller government guy, and that's what would guide me.
According to a recent poll from Monmouth University, only 25% of Republicans believe that climate change is a very serious problem. What do you think?
Well, I think the polar ice cap is melting, and you know, our coastlines are going to be rearranged when that happens, and you may very well see no more snow in the White Mountains. So I take that sort of thing pretty seriously.
But if you're trying to get the Republican nomination for president, how do you handle that issue that 75% of the party, according to that poll, is not with you on the importance
of
dealing
with climate
change?
Well, I really don't think it's helpful for the president of the United States to say, oh, all this stuff about climate and global warming, it's just a hoax. I mean, the evidence is pretty clear, and I think the president did the nation and the world a disservice in pulling us out of the Paris Accords.
What about the issue of gun control? You called for a statewide ban on assault weapons in Massachusetts when you were governor. Only about a quarter of Republicans favor that, according to Gallup.
Yeah, no, I would not be in favor of outlawing rifles today. We have 300 million rifles out there in private hands, perfectly legally obtained, and I would not be in favor of that.
So how do you get those Republicans? When you look at President Trump, who has 90% approval among Republicans, how do you win those people over?
Well, I tell people what I'm going to do. What I'm going to do is be an economic conservative. I'm going to cut spending. I'm going to cut taxes. I'm going to be responsible about the environment. That was historically a Republican initiative. Teddy Roosevelt and other Republican presidents, including Richard Nixon, were very important for environmental protection. I'm not going to go around pitting group against group and thrusting individuals into a corner. I think that's the opposite of a healthily functioning democracy. So I really don't favor the president's strategy of dividing people and setting group against group and marginalizing individuals. So I would be a very different kind of president than Donald Trump.
China is expected to become the world's largest economy in 2024. How would you deal with the rising influence of China? Do you think of China as an adversary or a partner?
Well, I think of them as a counterparty, which is somewhere between an adversary and a partner. But it's, you know, someone to be taken seriously. But I would try to treat all nations respectfully. I think the Chinese and the Americans could come to agreement fairly quickly if they treated each other with respect. You know, there's some rough spots. The Chinese attitude towards intellectual property leaves a lot to be desired, and you'd have to address that issue head on before, you know, opening up all the markets 100%. But I think there's a path forward there to a mutually successful free trade between nations. In general, I'm a free trader. I'm the opposite of Mr. Trump, who says he's a tariff man. His first reaction in foreign policy is tariffs and sanctions, sanctions and tariffs. Let's be negative towards other nations. You know, I don't think so. I don't think it's a zero-sum game the way the president seems to.
Did you think about running as a Democrat for president?
Negative. Never. Never did.
And would you think about running as a third party candidate if you don't get the Republican nomination?
No. You know, I did run with my friend, Governor Gary Johnson of New Mexico, on the Libertarian ticket last time around. And I've always been, you know, a Republican since I was 18 years old, tending towards the liberty side of the Republican Party. But no, I've never considered being a Democrat.
Governor Weld, if you were to become president, what would you do on day one? What would be the first thing you would do?
I probably would cut spending. I think that's got to set the tone for the discipline that the national administration owes to the American public.
That is former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, a Republican who has formed an exploratory committee to run for president in 2020. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
There is mixed news for home buyers. Mortgage rates have fallen to 14-month lows ahead of the busy spring buying season. On the other hand, lending standards are getting tighter as the Federal Housing Administration tries to crack down on risky loans for first-time buyers. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She joins us now. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So let's start with interest rates. They are down to 4.3% for a 30-year fixed loan. That is thanks in part to Fed policy, the Fed saying that it is not going to raise or likely not going to raise interest rates for the rest of the year. That's got to be good news for homebuyers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, listen, a lot of, especially of the first-time homebuyers, were kind of getting ready to plunge into the market last year. Their incomes were up. Maybe they have sort of squirreled away those necessary down payments. And then, boom, we saw mortgage rates rise. And there was some concern that there was going to be lots of growth, and that pushed up mortgage rates. Still, I will say that even if you want to come into the market right now, in many places, the prices have gone up quite a bit, and we still have a lack of housing in many, many markets. So it's still tough for that first-time home buyer.
So what's going on with restricting how many people can get loans or first-time home buyers from getting loans? Why is the FHA making it harder to get a mortgage?
So if you don't remember, here's your little FHA boot camp. The FHA really tries to help some borrowers who don't have the best of credit, maybe less than sort of the 650 of the FICO score, or maybe also just has not the highest of income, but it's consistent income. The FHA has tried to bring those homeowners into the market. And back in 2016, it actually loosened the standards even more. They said in 2016, even if you have a credit score that's less than 620 or you have a high debt-to-income ratio, you could qualify for an FHA. Well, guess what? As of today, the FHA says, whoops, a few years later, we're not so happy about this. They're reversing it. This could impact about 4 to 5% of the FHA loans that are originated in a given year.
And by the way, the average credit score for borrowers is now 670, which is the lowest average in a decade. What's going on there?
Well, you know, this is partially has to do with the fact that we went from sort of feast or famine. So running up to the huge housing boom and even at the very top, it was as if you really had no lending standards. And what we came to find out is that that's not a great idea. That's not a great recipe for a housing market. And when the financial crisis hit and housing bottomed out, everyone went to the other extreme. Like, gosh, you have to have sterling credit. You have to have a gazillion dollars down before we'll give you a loan. And so what we have seen is that a little bit push to the middle. And we also have seen that there may be other metrics for judging whether or not someone is credit worthy than just that individual score. I'm not completely freaked out by the low FICO score. Let's see how much of these, how many of these home buyers are able to handle that in the next downturn.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
This afternoon, reporters asked President Trump if Special Counsel Robert Mueller acted honorably in his investigation into possible collusion with Russians interfering in the 2016 election. And Trump said yes, despite attacking the investigation over the past 2 years. Of course, Attorney General William Barr notified Congress yesterday that Special Counsel Mueller did not find evidence of collusion, and Barr himself concluded that Mueller didn't find enough evidence of obstruction. On Fox and Friends this morning, Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani picked up on that.
Any lawyer never gets a letter like this. Usually you get a letter that says, we don't have enough evidence. In this case, we have complete vindication. Mm-hmm.
But again, Barr also makes it clear in his letter that Mueller didn't have enough evidence of obstruction and did not also exonerate the president of obstruction. Former FBI Director James Comey, who was fired by President Trump, which some pointed to as obstruction, tweeted out a picture of a forest with the phrase, "So many questions." Well, let's ask some. Joining us now, NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
And can you pick up on something we're hearing a lot, even from some of the president's defenders who are our listeners? You know, Barr said Special Counsel Mueller didn't find conspiracy or collusion. And they're saying, wow, even Manafort handing over polling data or the Trump Tower meeting with Russians who promised dirt on Hillary Clinton or Michael Flynn and Jeff Sessions meeting with the Russian ambassador and either lying or not coming forward with that. Why isn't that collusion? What's your answer?
Well, you know, Robin, I'm not a lawyer, and as a colleague of mine used to say, that's a great credit to the legal profession. But what appears to have happened here is there's some amount of weight that has to be in the preponderance of the evidence as uncovered by these investigators to break the tape, if you will, or cross the pane of the goal into actual lawbreaking, whether it's conspiracy or collusion, which has kind of become the popular shorthand. And according to what the Attorney General, Mr. Barr, said in his summary to Congress about what the special counsel's office found, it didn't get there. So we don't know that there wasn't any evidence. And in fact, one of the reasons for this investigation was there were a number of contacts, some of which you've talked about, in 2016 between President Trump's campaign and Russians or their agents. But according to what we read from Barr about what Mueller's office uncovered, there wasn't enough there or there wasn't enough evidence about what they discovered to actually put a prosecution into motion. Now, we should also say no one except for a very small number of people has actually seen Mueller's findings, his actual report, and that's why the calls have become near unanimous from Democrats and including many Republicans to release that underlying material as well, so that we will be able not only to see those top-line conclusions that we've been reading since yesterday, but what exactly Mueller's investigators uncovered. We don't know when that's going to happen, but the Attorney General says he's going to go through this Mueller material and take out grand jury testimony and classified intelligence information and other things, and then eventually Congress and presumably the public will be able to see what's there.
Yeah, and we're wondering, too, your thoughts on, you know, whether an answer might be in a footnote in Barr's letter in which he described collusion or conspiracy as an agreement, tacit or expressed, between the Trump campaign and the Russian government on election interference. So they might be saying that even if a president said, as President Trump did, you know, Russia, if you're listening, try to get Clinton's 30,000 missing emails, and maybe Trump even knew through a friend that Russia had delivered emails to WikiLeaks, that isn't collusion. That isn't an agreement between the Russian government and President Trump.
It may also have been possible, as people who worked for Trump in the campaign or in his business have theorized since the election, that because nothing took place in Trump world without the president's approval, that he was aware, for example, that Donald Trump Jr. had scheduled a meeting in June of 2016 with a delegation from Russia that he had been told would bring him dirt on Hillary Clinton. The president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and the campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, also took part in that meeting. And of course, prosecutors have also said in their ongoing court case against the political consultant, Roger Stone, that top people in the Trump organization were trying to use intermediaries to get to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, which played such an important role in the 2016 interference storyline. However, even if that awareness did take place and even if those things did take place according to those court documents, again, what we intuit from Barr's summary of Mueller's conclusions is they could not get enough evidence to convince themselves that a prosecution was warranted of any of the people who haven't already been prosecuted, or certainly not the president, which is why we are where we are.
Yeah. And you remind us, this investigation was not started by Democrats. It was started by U.S. intelligence agents. Another reason why the president's critics are so willing to see collusion, because the intelligence agencies were all concluding that the Russians interfered. The president said he believed President Putin over his own agencies at one point. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders being pressed this morning by CNN's John Berman about this evidence of Russian election interference that Barr said Mueller did present in his report.
Does the president concur that Russia did try to attack our election?
Certainly, and we've said that a number of times before. Russia and others tried to interfere with our elections. We know that they try to interfere. But the question that has constantly been ignored is who was in charge of government at the time that they interfered. It wasn't Donald Trump. Oh. It was Barack Obama. It was his intelligence.
Your thoughts on that response, and whether, as many people are saying, maybe now that that is conclusive in the Barr letter and, the Mueller report, the White House will start to do something about Russian interference in elections.
Well, that's one of the big questions now that this Mueller saga is moving into a new chapter. The press secretary, of course, is correct when she said the president has made comments along the line since the election or since his inauguration that have included Russia in the number of foreign malefactors who have been trying to interfere in American democracy. But the president has also gone back and forth about that. He hasn't had a consistent position since the election or since his inauguration. And you also mentioned a moment ago when he traveled to Finland last year, to Helsinki, for his summit with the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. He exonerated Putin while he was on stage with him when he was asked about this by the press. The president then came back to Washington and restated his earlier position, saying that, in fact, he did support the intelligence community's conclusions about that interference. One of the reasons people believed there might have been some underlying conspiracy or collusion or other skullduggery to be uncovered by the special counsel's office was the president's back and forthiness about this collusion issue and about the interference issue. And of course, from what we understand from the special counsel's office, there was no justification for that, according to what Mueller said. Again, we'll have to see what the special counsel's underlying materials are. But the other question going forward is, with this cloud for Republicans dispelled as they feel it is, and the president and his allies clearly feeling very good about this, will he be any more aggressive in terms of the policies used by the United States against Russia, against China, against Iran and other actors, in terms of cyber attacks against the United States, in terms of agitation on social media that tries to pit Americans against each other with fake accounts and so-called fake news? And we also don't know what else Mueller found about that interference. There could have been other ways in which Russia or other governments interfered in 2016. And when his full report comes out, or whatever we get to see of it, I certainly am going to be looking very closely at that to see if there's anything more than the cyber attacks and hacking and dumping we know, or the social media agitation from the troll factory at the Internet Research Agency.
Well, Democrats are threatening to subpoenas to get Mueller's evidence, and they say that Mueller should have interviewed President Trump. He just had to submit a written questionnaire. And there are ongoing investigations of the president in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan focusing on his financial dealings. But meanwhile, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Lindsey Graham indicated Republicans may be calling for an investigation of investigators, for instance, of the FBI's use of surveillance warrants and the so-called Steele dossier that reportedly discredits Trump, and of former FBI Director James Comey for not prosecuting Hillary Clinton on her emails. In about the minute we have, your thoughts on whether that will gain steam?
Well, they will try and make it gain steam in the Senate, which Republicans still control. And Senator Graham is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee there. He has the ability to ask Justice Department officials to come and talk to his committee. It's a very popular subject for Republicans because they believe, for example, that Carter Page's civil rights might have been violated in 2016 by the government surveillance that was taking place. The president also, at an earlier stage of this story, promised to release a full and unredacted copy of the FISA warrant that was sought by investigators to look into his communications. Page was never charged. We understand there are no more indictments to come from Mueller, and so that could be a cause celeb for Graham and Republicans if, in fact, they can establish there was some overreach. We don't know what that's going to find, but we're certainly not done with that aspect of the scandal or even the wider after effects of the whole Robert Mueller era.
A national security editor's work is never done. Phil Ewing, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
It's been more than a month since teachers in Denver walked out of the classroom for 3 days to demand higher salaries. It was one of several successful teacher strikes around the country in recent months. But there are still major problems to be solved within Denver schools. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine reports on the battle for school reform that's ahead now that teachers are back to work.
Even at the height of the strike, Denver teachers knew it was about more than pay. The top priorities of the union now?
Having more manageable class sizes.
Henry Roman is president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association.
The need to address the teacher turnover crisis. Having more wraparound services like social worker, nurses, psychologists.
Those are ideas Superintendent of Schools Susana Cordova agrees with, particularly helping schools with the highest need. And she hopes teachers will help her convince state lawmakers to return money it has borrowed from school budgets since 2008.
We need to be working arm in arm with our teachers to help fix the state funding system.
The state shortfall to Denver this year is $70 million. Teachers will also be watching where the district lands on other issues that surfaced during the strike. Valerie Henderson told her fellow educators at this rally, the fight
is also a fight against failing school reform efforts and a chance for teachers to build our collective power.
The union has long been rankled about reforms enacted over the past decade. The district's performance ranked as one of the worst in the state, so it made big changes, rapidly expanding charter schools. District officials point to higher test scores and college admissions as proof they're working. Critics, like the teachers' union, say dig deeper. They say the changes have siphoned off students and financial support from neighborhood schools. They say charter schools may be good for students who attend them, but most Denver students don't attend those schools and are left behind. Roman says in the long run,
the idea is that as you improve the level of support and those schools start doing better, that the choice would be right there. It's your neighborhood school.
Math teacher Corey Montre is in the thick of the reforms. He teaches in Northeast Denver, where the district began phasing out the struggling Montbello High School starting 8 years ago. There are now 12 high schools in the region.
You've chopped up a community and made all these tiny schools compete for resources and kids.
Montre is also the wrestling coach for the entire Northeast now.
I pull from 11 schools. 11 schools.
He has to recruit at lunch, during planning times, takes days off to recruit, on top of coaching and teaching duties.
And that's time that my students aren't getting with me.
While Montbello was dismantled, Montre cites another school, Abraham Lincoln High School, still standing, but hard hit by charter schools located inside the public high school itself.
Lincoln, what is Lincoln anymore? They have two charter schools just pushing them out.
Lincoln's enrollment has plummeted 63% since 2013. That means fewer electives for kids who remain and lost money for every student that leaves. While the district and school reformers still strongly defend the charter and innovation schools, there does seem to be room for discussion now with new superintendent Susana Cordova in charge. She took the job in January. Cordova says charters have pushed district-run schools to better define their improvement plans, work with families, and improve school identities. She says competition can help all schools, but says now,
it's become increasingly difficult in an environment where we see declining enrollment for that competition to take on the healthy aspects.
And A Plus Colorado, a strong believer in charter schools and the reforms, is even ready to consider changes.
Might be time to reform the reform, right?
That's Landon Mascarenhas of A Plus. He says his group just launched research on the district's initiatives to improve schools.
It's taking out the different strategies and different approaches that have taken place over the past 10 years and really weighing them out in terms of what has driven improvement, what hasn't driven improvement, and what do we need to stop, start, and continue differently.
Ariel Taylor-Smith, co-founder of Transform Education Now, says the reforms have fallen short. She notes the city has one of the highest achievement gaps between students of color and white students in the nation.
8 out of 10 white students in Denver Public Schools are meeting college-ready expectations on the SAT. And 3 out of 10 students of color on it. 3 out of 10. That's a unacceptable gap.
Cordova says fixing that achievement gap is one of her highest priorities. But the teachers' union says it will work with Cordova. But members rallied behind another idea during the strike.
When you head to the ballot box this November, let's flip this board.
That is, electing new school board members who champion investing in district-run neighborhood schools. That's months away, though. Time for the new superintendent and the teachers to see whether they can agree on the best approach to address the complex issues facing the district. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brundine in Denver.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.